Okay, well, I think we're about ready to start. My name is Greg Bauer, and I lead the Scientific and Engineering Applications Report Group, and I probably see it from time to time for many of you, or with many of you. Please keep in mind that when you connect up to try to mute your phone, if I hear too much noise, I'll just do a blanket mute of everyone, and if you need to be unmuted, just connect up through the web conference and raise your hand, and I can add you back in. Let's see here. Hopefully we won't have audio quality problems from our end. We occasionally experience some network congestion issues with our link system. So hopefully we'll get that happening too often. So the agenda for today is kind of a jam-packed agenda. We have I forgot to add one thing in there. Let's see. So I guess I put it down below. A bunch of things on the agenda today. Probably the highlight of the day is Mark Ebersole from NVIDIA, who's on the call, and he's going to give us a nice overview of the advanced features of the K20X that we have on our system. We have 4,224 of those right now, so that'll be interesting to learn about some of the features that you may or may not know about. And we'll briefly go over requests for people to want to nominate people for our user advisory committee and upcoming events that are happening, some information about some additional features to the Blue Waters portal, and of course we always complete our teleconference call with requests for suggestions, future events, and publications and presentations as they happen. All right, so kind of slightly out of order here with what I have on the agenda, but the first thing we want to talk about briefly with Bill Kramer is the importance of science impact input from science teams. So we have a large number of PRAC, GLTPC, and Illinois allocations in the system with a pretty substantial amount of very interesting science happening, and we need to learn more about that the impact that we're making with you on the science that's coming off the system. So Bill, you have some words you want to say?
So, yes. I wanted to just reiterate the importance for both Blue Waters here, but also for all the science teams in terms of trying to show the impact of the ability to have access to such a resource at this scale. And this comes from a variety of different places. But there is a great deal of interest in what is going on and what types of activities are being made possible by Blue Waters. And that goes to anywhere from wanting to have NSF or public affairs or other people be able to talk about it to encouraging our stakeholders and funders that this is a very good investment and that it should continue, not just for just one machine, but beyond that. So I know you've been very responsive when some of the points of contact reach out to you and ask for what's happening lately and what have you been doing. We're going to be trying to do a additional work in those areas. We'll be contacting you about, but basically not just kind of the activities that are just produced, you know, having a paper published or a paper submitted for a conference. But we're going to try to be acquiring more insight into how big of a difference is this way of doing business than it is in other types of ways that you do your scientific and engineering inquiries. How big of an advantage in time to solution? Are there things that have been able to be done to get results faster, to make more productivity of your teams? And we very much like your cooperation in doing this so that we can build a really strong case for continuing this type of investment from NSF so that we have expanded capabilities in the future. You'll be hearing more specifics about that, but I wanted to let you know that this is a very high priority for us. It comes from NSF at the highest level of wanting to figure out how do we understand this as well as other people. So we have a symbiotic relationship where we're providing the resources, but without resources at this scale, you may not be able to accomplish the goals that you have. So we have to understand how to jointly make the best case. We would appreciate also knowing if you're doing your own explanations, not just in your scientific meetings, but say to program managers who fund you with other streams, things like that, and are looking to work with you so that we all benefit from being able to maintain this type of investment. So.
Great. Thanks. Well, so many of you, especially the NSF PRAC PIs and delegates, have been either contacted currently or will be contacted by your point of contact person regarding some of this information as we go along. All right, so the next item that was sent out by Bill a little while ago, so the deadline is coming up for nominations for members of our Science and Engineering Advisory Committee, acronym CTAC. And we've had some people provide a nomination, and you're welcome to self-nominate as well. So this advisory committee is something that's important for Blue Waters as a project as a whole to provide input to Bill Kramer, the project director here, for a variety of aspects on the project. So if you didn't get the email, please let me know, but, or you can look here on the slide. But if you're interested in participating, there are some requirements that you have to be a PI or a co-PI or involved in the Blue Waters project, allocated in some form or another. For that either you think should be nominated for the committee or yourself as well. So that's coming up October 24th. Other things coming up, we do have some system maintenance coming up. We haven't announced it yet because we're still trying to nail down that date for this, but one will be coming up next week, and we have a 7-day advance notice. So that looks to be October 31st, Thursday. So Jeremy Enos, our lead admin here, shaking his head yes, so it'll be next Thursday, October 31st. We'll have a possibly half-day outage or upgrade of the system management software. So that's basically a fairly transparent upgrade. You won't notice really anything different. Some other items will be upgraded along the way, more than torque probably, and a few other different subsystems of the Blue Waters project, and Blue Waters system as a whole. And then coming up in the second week of November, we'll have a substantially longer outage, full-day outage for an upgrade of Craig. The environment to 42 UP02. This is a pretty good and important upgrade. It will provide CUDA 5.5 to the XK system. So a lot of GPU users have been asking about some of the features that are available under CUDA 5.5. Fixes a few other things, and one of the new products coming out from Cray is something called RUR, which is a improved resource usage reporting tool. Many of you see some of it coming out of AppRun. At the end of an AppRun command, you get input or output regarding things like max RSS and some user time and system time. So there's some improvements to the framework for that, and it'll allow us to provide more detailed AppRun usage information, not just for CPU, but for also GPU applications. And it also provides the framework for us to do more detailed reporting for AppRun, for example, possibly some hardware counter information as well, automatic. So we're quite eager to get that going, and so that'll be second week of November. The date hasn't been pinpointed at the moment, but we'll give you at least a week's notice on that as well.
Yep. Also included in that, worth mentioning, would be a lecture client update in the second week of November there, in that second outage, as well as some major fixes to the file system that should improve its stability.
So some other traffic that's been going over to the Blue Waters mailing list is the announcement of an education allocation. So for instructors, professors, people who are teaching classes or working on workshops. This is the way of making Blue Waters resource as part of your coursework. So there was an allocation process for that. There are some limitations about who's eligible, and that's all documented on our portal. So if you're interested in possibly using the system in a workshop or a class, hopefully we'll be having a workshop coming up pretty soon that'll take place on the XK portion of the system. I think that's been announced. All right, will be announced soon. So if that's something that you're interested in, please take a look at that. And then the first week of December, we have a workshop coming up, 3rd, 4th, 5th at NCSA. It'll also be available through WebEx. Some of the topics that we're working on, working right now with Mark to get a couple-hour advanced NVIDIA Kepler programming presentation. We've been working with the HDF group to get an advanced HDF programming presentation available. Concepts on presenting performance speedup, which is kind of how not to fool the masses with how well you're improving the performance of your code, and some things that we talked about in the past, things like job resiliency, programming models, and hopefully we'll get that agenda out any day now. I've been hoping to get it out since last Friday, but hasn't happened yet. So we'll announce that once that gets finalized. New feature on the portal that people have been inquiring about. So we have a new portal usage tool, which lets you drill down, dive down through the allocation bodies, the different allocation bodies on the system. So if you go to the Blue Waters portal and you look under system status, you'll see a usage tab come up, and that lets you have a graphical and tabular view of the usage by allocation and by project of the different teams that are on the system. And it'll give you how much has been used and how much they've been allocated, plus some history information down to the user level. And some of this is similar to what's available through XDMod, which is also something that'll be coming down the pipeline, that eventually our usage information will be available through an XDMod website. Not quite there, but it's getting very close. And if there's any questions about that, feel free to send email to help.cw, and the person who prepared the portlet for that is willing to ask questions if you see any problems. Okay, so I think we're about ready. So Mark Ebersol from NVIDIA is on the line, and I'm going to hand over the presenter baton to him in a second here. So he's was recommended to me by Professor Wen Mei-Hu over in the Computer Science Department. He's done a lot of development with NVIDIA on CUDA practices, and so he's going to give us an overview of some of the features of the K20X. We've had from time to time questions from Blue Waters users who are moving onto the system about what's the difference between our GPU and earlier versions, for example, the Fermi system, and what things you need to look at when you're porting your CUDA code or looking at OpenACC on the system. So,
are his slides available outside the...
as soon as the talk's over, Steve. Sorry about that. So these are on there, but Mark's are not on there yet. They'll be on the portal under the usual workshop webinar page.
Well, I'm having trouble with the web application, so if you're showing them, I can't see them.
Yeah, we will be showing them. Let me see. Mark, do you think you could forward that email to me so I could post that while you're doing your presentation?
I've actually got to go through them and clean up some stuff before I send them to you. I can't send them as is. Sorry. Right.
Okay. Steve, you may try a different browser. We've noticed from time to time that it depends on the browser and the version of Java that is causing problems. So I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing here for a second.
I like how you found my CUDA hamster logo. That was nice.
Yeah, no, good. He's also available on various social media, so if you have questions, you can always post them directly to Mark. All right, so Mark, you should have the baton now.
All right, let me get sharing. right. Can you see? You see my slides?
Yes. Not in presenter view yet. There we go. Looks good.
Yeah, there it goes. All right, excellent. Thanks you guys for having me. I apologize for missing last month, about a couple of days before I was supposed to do this in September. We were had our life jackets on in the middle of the Colorado flood, so I had to skip out on that. I also apologize, I'm on the tail end of a cold, so I'll try to mute myself before I sneeze and blow out anybody's eardrums, but if I do, I apologize. So yeah, I'm going to give you a quick overview of the new features available on Kepler. I'm going to try not to go into too much detail on any one of them since we only have a short amount of time. I'll ask that you save your questions to the end. I'll try to save about 15 minutes at the end to answer any questions anybody has. And if I can't answer them, you're more than welcome to send me an email and I'll make sure they get answered. And then very briefly at the end, I'll touch on the CUDA 5.5 features, which we released and you guys are installing in November, just so you're aware of what's coming up. Kepler, it can be a little bit confusing. Kepler is actually a family of chips. There's different chips within it. The one you guys are talking about, the K20X, is based on GK110. We did release some earlier versions of Kepler that were more gaming oriented, the GK104 and GK107. So some people get a little confused if they try to go develop on their, you know, laptop or something that doesn't have the same features as what they have in their supercomputer. So that's usually the reason why, that they're, you know, their high-end GPU is the GK110, yet they may have a gaming GPU at home. So it does have some of these features, but definitely not all of them. So K20X, we really focused on getting the perf up from Fermi. As you can see, you know, just from the graph here, we did basically a 3x performance of both single precision and double precision. So now in double precision, we're getting over 1 teraflop, you know, in a single GPU. We're up around 1.3, 1.4, depending on the application you're running. We're really focused on the perf per watt, you know, trying not to put, you know, perf's great, but if you're burning too much electricity, you just can't run as fast. So we really focused on that as well. So these are my two marketing slides that I throw at you. We really redesigned the SMs with the Kepler versus what we had in Fermi. You know, we only have 15 of these, what we call SMXs now in Fermi, or in Kepler. This is obviously not what the chip looks like. We call this a architecture diagram. So it's just a rough layout of what it actually would be. The SMs are much bigger than they were in Fermi. We have 192 single precision, what we call CUDA cores, and also 64 double precision cores in each one of these SMs. Those are all the little green and orange dots you're seeing. We also larger cache and 385 GDDR5. So this is kind of the high level view of what we did with the GK1 chip, and then I'll dive into more detail on a lot of these. So just balancing of resources versus what we had in Fermi. We really focused on getting floating point throughput increased, since that's what the majority of the applications are using, is floating point. We doubled the number of blocks you can have per SM, so you can just schedule more work. We've also increased the number of threads you have per block, so you can have more, you know, threads per block and more threads per SM. We doubled the size of our register file and the bandwidth for it, so it's 2F on those, and then increased our shared memory bandwidth. That was another big requirement we got. And then with all that increase, we did keep our shared memory size the same. So shared memory is what you use. It's usually shared between L1 and shared memory. We did add another configuration for this. So you can either go heavy on the shared memory size and very little L1 cache, or heavy on the L1 cache and little shared memory, or now you can go equal on both. So it's a new configuration we added in Kepler. With the doubling of the register file size, we also increased the number of registers per thread. So we went from 63 in Fermi up to 255 in Kepler. We found that in Fermi, a lot of applications were oversubscribing the registers and having to spill out into memory, either L1 or even the global memory, which would really slow applications down. You know, you make one small change and you get a huge hit in performance. So we increased the number of registers you can have per thread, but if you've done the math, you can obviously see we only doubled the size of the register file, but we quadrupled the number of registers you can have per thread. So this, if you do go to the full number of registers, you will limit the number of threads you are able to use. So that is one thing to be aware of. We also worked on some new SMX instructions, so instructions actually in the SM. A big one we added was the shuffle, the warp shuffle. I'll go into a little more detail in a minute, but it basically allows you to swap data within a warp very quickly without having to use shared memory. We also worked hard on the atomic operations. We really increased the speed within the SM and added a couple more for more functional with what we had with the integers. And a lot of these are compiler generated, so it's very easy to use. And I'll give an example, like for say the shuffle down here in a bit. Yeah, so the shuffle, we have 4 different variations. This just again avoids using the worth having to use shared memory to exchange data. You can do, index, basically any to any. You can set up where you want the different words to go. You can just shift to the right, shift to the left, and then you can do the butterfly swap. So we have a lot of good examples of using this on our docs.nvidia.com site, so you can actually go in and see how this is used. But I'm not going to go into too much detail here. Just want to make sure you're aware that these are out there. The new atomic instructions, so we made int, our 64-bit in parity with what we had with int32. We also really focused on getting the performance increased, because while we had these in earlier versions, they just weren't fast enough, and they really didn't make a lot of sense to use them. It made it easy to program, but it just didn't go fast, so we worked on really increasing the performance where we could. So our slowest ones, we got up by 10x performance increase, and then the fastest atomics, we doubled those. So if you had used these before or tried them and they were too slow, definitely encourage you to try them again and see if it's fast enough for you. All right, just as an example, doing a sum reduction now, I can actually do this with atomics versus having to actually use memory. So it can be very useful, makes your code a lot easier to write. For texture cache, if you haven't used this before, so in graphics, a texture cache is just a read-only cache with some hardware filtering, so you can do different things based on your texture. People have used this before in compute, but it was a little colluded to try to use. It's kind of hard to write in your code. So with Kepler, we added a straight pass from this read-only data cache, so you can just bypass the texture unit. You want to do this because if you want to do this, it's a separate pipeline from shared and L1, so you're not conflicting there. If you have read-only data, it's a really fast miss bandwidth because you're never writing to it, so it's optimized for reads. It also allows you to do unaligned accesses, depending on how you're accessing your data. It's very flexible, and it's very easy to use. You're just basically using const and then __ restricts, I think I have here. So the pilot does this for you. You just indicate, what your pointer is coming in as a const restrict, and then it will set it to use the read-only cache. So if you know you have read-only data for whatever it is, this is a great way to get some speed up in your application. As far as the memory system, we really worked on our memory controller. The GDDR5 is a pretty fast memory, but with Fermi, we weren't able to quite get to the peak memory clocks. So Kepler, we're actually getting a lot more memory bandwidth use now. We doubled the size of our L2. And the bandwidth of it, so it's bigger and it goes faster. And then, which would affect you guys on the Blue Waters, is we made the ECC implementation a lot faster. So ECC is the error correction, making sure that none of your bits are flipping randomly, and if it does, trying to correct it. A lot of the GeForce cards, they don't have this on there, so even though they have a lot of the capabilities or maybe as fast, they don't have a lot of the memory protection that the Tesla class GPUs have. So we worked hard to get the overhead of this down. So one of the big features with Kepler, if you've seen any of our presentations on this in the last couple of years, you've probably seen this slide. It's called dynamic parallelism. I have a few slides talking about it, but in short, it essentially allows you to have a single thread that's running on the GPU to launch an entire new grid of work. Whereas previously, you would have to always go back to the CPU, and it would have to then in turn launch more work on the GPU. You just get this ping pong effect. You can now just really move most of that work over the GPU, and it will just run itself, which frees the CPU up to do things it does well. The non-parallel code or dealing with I/O, you can actually having two co-processors instead of the CPU having to babysit the GPU. Our kind of contrived example, this is useful, if you're looking at this fluid dynamic simulation of a jet engine, I believe this is, your options were to do a really coarse grid for, low accuracy, but it went fast. You could do a super fine grid, where you get really accurate data, but it's super slow. And then now with dynamic parallelism, it's much easier to say, start really broad, find out where there is work, and then really focus in. One of the good examples we've shown is our Banzai galaxy simulation, where if there's no stars, it doesn't do any work. And then if there's a bunch of stars, it spends most of its time there. You could do this on Fermi, but it was very, very complicated. That was a lot of saving data and going to the CPU. One of the good examples we use is Quicksort. On Fermi, Quicksort was like 80 lines of code. Quicksort is a very simple algorithm. But when you were adding dynamic parallelism, it went down to the 5 lines of code like it's supposed to be. Obviously, you probably wouldn't want to do Quicksort on the GPU. There's faster ways to sort things. It's a good example to show how dynamic parallelism has made programming the GPUs much easier. I mean, it is, if you've done CUDA before, it's essentially CUDA on the GPU. I think something like 96% of the API calls and everything has just moved to the GPU. There's just a few memory API calls that don't make sense to call from the GPU, but it looks the same as you've been writing. You don't have to learn anything new. You can do device synchronizes, you can do streams, you can do events, launches, you can call libraries. you know, like the Kurang library or QFFT, you can call those from the GPU now. So it's really not learning anything new. You're just moving your CUDA code into the GPU side. Where is it useful? Anywhere you have nested parallelism. So we tend to show an example where each time you do some of your algorithmic steps, you would have to return back to the CPU and it would launch more work. That's an example we use a lot, but that's not the only one. Pretty much anywhere there's nested parallelism is a good use for dynamic parallelism. You know, we have this another contrived example here. So there's a lot of parallelism in this code. There's something like 34,800 times that the evaluate function is going to be called, but traditionally, or this is only really exposed 29 calls at a time. And so, you know, your F statement is going to go through its 12 loops calling the do something of V, and then that calls in or something. And so there's a lot of parallelism there, but it's really hard to get access to that. And traditionally, with Fermi, you would have to flatten this hierarchy, which would mean a big rewrite of the code and the structure of the algorithm. And so people didn't want to tackle that. But by dynamic parallelism, now it's you just keep the structure the same. You know, you launch your initial kernel of just one block with 12 threads, you know, a very small block. But immediately those 12 threads are launching more grids, each with 100 threads. And then those are immediately launching another grid with 29 threads. So you very quickly fill up your GPU. We thought of Fermi, it was a very powerful chip, but it was very hard to keep it busy. So dynamic parallelism was one of our big answers on Kepler to help keep the GPU busy. To do this, we had to add a new unit to our chip called the grid management unit. It essentially sits between our stream queue management and the work distributor. And so it basically can handle thousands of grids at a time. You know, it can, if a parent grid launches a child grid, it can suspend it and keep track of it. You can also see the line, the white line coming up from the SM back up to the grid management unit. This is just our way of showing that, you know, an SM can actually launch a whole new grid. So this was the key piece to enable a dynamic parallelism in Kepler. Another new feature we had, Hyper-Q talks about a couple features. I'm going to go over both of them. It can be a little confusing at times. But essentially, it allows you to, we now have 32 hardware queues inside the GPU, whereas in Fermi, we only had one hardware queue. So even though we supported streams within software, it all got funneled down into one hardware queue. So in Kepler, we now have 32 of these, which makes it a lot easier to get concurrent grids going or concurrent work. In Fermi, it was supported, but it was really hard in the software to actually get that done. This is definitely interesting on MPI applications, and but it's not limited to it. So for a non-MPI app, say you're just, you know, you're working within a single GPU or your code's working in a single GPU, you can still use multiple streams, but it removes the false dependencies we had with Fermi. You know, for example, here we had two streams, you know, stream one's calling A, B, and C, and then stream two calls P, Q, and R. Well, the free, even though these streams are independent of each other, you would actually get a false dependency, and the only overlap you would get would be between kernel P and C. And so that's not what you're expecting. You're expecting, you know, C, B, and A to go, and R, Q, and P to all run concurrently. But that's not what you would get. It was hard to actually write this to get this in Fermi. But with Hyper-Q, it's just as you same code. You don't have to change anything in your code. It just works better because now we now have 32 hardware queues to send work to. This is very useful for building a pipeline in your code to really, especially if you don't have, or if you have so much data, it's not sitting on a single GPU at a time. You can really overlap your work and data movement. And people have written before in Fermi, again, this is not new code, but now it actually just works as you expected. You know, you send some data to the host, you process it with the kernel, you move that data back, you do something on the CPU once it's been done, and then you rotate your streams and you just keep doing this to send data over. And if you profile this with Fermi, you had these big gaps while the CPU was doing work, while the callback was going. The GPU just had to sit there and wait. Again, it was more dependent on the CPU in the Fermi days. And so you could fix this by doing a first launch, but that was very hard to write, and it made the code very complex and hard to maintain. Now with Hyper-Q, you profile the same code just compiled and running on Fermi or on Kepler. You see, we get much better overlap, and you get your overall throughput of your application is a lot faster. So now with Hyper-Q MPI, now you haven't actually had this since CUDA 5.0 on Cray machines. It's a new feature for the rest of the world, CUDA 5.5. But it essentially allows multiple MPI ranks to talk to a single GPU. And again, this is a great way to help keep the GPU busy. It's got a lot of horsepower. You don't want to have most of it sitting there idle. So now you can have different MPI rings to talk to this. It's called a multi-process server. It's a process that's running on each of the nodes that will then farm out that work to the GPU in a single context. And again, it's from the programmer side. There's nothing you have to do here. You're just using your MPI to talk to the GPU. The admins would set this up on your system to work with your CUDA jobs. So that's a good overview of all the new Kepler features, the main part that I believe guys are interested in. I'm real quickly going to go over the CUDA 5.5 features that are coming up. This will just be a quick little laundry list, and you're more than welcome to ask any questions about any of these. Probably don't care about the Linux RPM dev installers, but we now have the ability to use package installers for CUDA, both the driver and the toolkit. We've added the concept of stream priorities, so now you can actually give priority to streams. I think the numbers go from 1 to 10, and so if the scheduler is looking for work to do, it'll base it on the stream priority. I think somebody needs to mute. All right. The other big feature with CUDA 5.5 is we really worked on dynamic parallelism performance improvements. So with CUDA 5 and Kepler, the first goal is just to get it out there and make it work. So it was a more of a programmability feature than a performance feature. And then in CUDA 5.5, we really focused on getting the performance up. So if you've used dynamic parallelism before and it wasn't fast enough, I definitely encourage you to try it again. We've seen, 3 to 5x improvements in different areas. And again, you don't have to change your code. It's just all on the back end side. The multiprocess server I already talked about on Linux. That's just going broader to everybody else. And we now support single GPU debugging on Linux, so if you are developing locally before going to the supercomputer, you can, on your Linux side, you can actually debug the GPU that's driving your display. This is a really useful feature, too. You don't have multiple GPUs in your system. You can do breakpoints, run multiple CUDA applications, all different spots in the debugger while it's driving the display all at the same time. I added these links here, these bit.ly links, so I've been creating what we call CUDA casts. They're essentially little screencasts that talk about different features of CUDA and the GPUs, so you can go watch them. They're little, usually 5 to 10 minute videos talking about some of these features. But we added remote debugging, so you can actually log in remotely to a node and debug. So if you're on your laptop, you can get direct access to a node over the network. You can debug the GPU remotely, which is a very useful feature if you're not sitting right next to the GPU. We added a lot of guided optimizations to our Visual Profiler. So the main reason you're going to GPUs is to get your code to go faster. So you really want to make sure you're using your profiler to drive your optimizations. And with the guided optimizations we've added, you can now load it up and it will walk you through the steps it thinks you need to take to improve your applications. It'll try to pick the kernel that's, spending the most amount of time and then drive you through how you can actually improve its performance. So you can use a combination of our command line profiling tool, NVProf, to actually get the data off your supercomputer for your GPUs and then load that data on your local machine and actually walk through the visual profiler. And it will, give you source level pointers, where in your code it thinks you can optimize. So it's a really useful tool with CUDA 5.5. I made a lot of enhancements to our QFFT library. Again, I made a video on the QFFTW additions we added, but we made some perf improvements and some programmability improvements. So I encourage you to look at that if you use QFFT. And then just release our LLVMVA compiler SDK, which you guys may not be too concerned about. So where do you learn more? So you can obviously ask me questions now. I think I went through this pretty quick. We've got about 20 minutes left. So for the GK110 white paper, so just go to your favorite search engine and search for GK110 white paper, and that'll bring it up, and it'll go into a lot more detail, a lot of stuff I talked about on Kepler. We also have a lot of talks recorded. We record every one of our talks from all our conferences and make them available online. So if you just go to this GPU Tech Comp site, you can just search for Kepler, and there'll be many, many talks on there, both from us and from external parties. We've moved all our documentation to a nice, easy, accessible HTML format on docs.nvidia.com. Prior to this, it was just scattered all over the internet, and many of the docs were 3 or 4 years old. It was quite the mess, so we're glad to have this all consolidated now in one nice area. All our samples are up there, and the kind of a great place to go for, the best practices guide and everything. For asking questions, we've actually been encouraging people to go to Stack Overflow. If you aren't aware, Stack Overflow is probably the place to go for developers on pretty much anything, CUDA being one of them. It's essentially a site where a few developers spend all their time looking at all the manuals, and then they answer questions that people have asked. So they are the ones doing reading the manual. But there's some, I think we're over 5,000 CUDA questions that have been asked and answered. So it's a great place to go for from either introductory level questions to really detailed questions. And if it's not answered, to ask it, because there's a lot of people who watch that forum, including some of our developer technologists at NVIDIA. They watch it on a daily basis. We also have our own forums at NVIDIA, devtalk.nvidia.com. These are great places to go if you can't find your question on Stack Overflow, but we also have a lot of good discussions about, you know, where CUDA's going or specific features on DevTalk, so it's another good place to go for forums. And also, you can always just email me, mebersol@nvidia.com, or also cudahamster@nvidia.com. If you don't ever remember my name, both of those come to me. If I can't answer them, I can certainly find the people to help you answer the question. So that's it for my quick talk. Like I said, that was going to be pretty quick, just to give you an overview of all the features available for Kepler. So I think we can open it up to questions now, if you have any.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark.
Yep.
Why don't you just keep the presentation handle for the time being, unless, in case there's something you want to show in response to a question. So I'll open up the questions from anyone who's currently connected up. I see we have about 20 people currently on. Are there any questions from people listening on today? Listening in? No one wants to ask a question. All right. Well, I have a couple.
Sure.
Let's see. So I guess people here that are in the conference room with me are a lot of them are members of our CS group, the support group that helps answer some of the questions that people have. And often we get a question from users saying, you know, I run my desktop GPU without ECC enabled, and I run X times faster than your GPU. And then when I run on your GPU, why can't I turn it off? And we have some, you know, some issues with support for that. What's the take from that? What's the typical, I guess, performance comparison that one might find for users who run with and without ECC? Is that something that's fairly easy to quantify based on the performance differences, just the hardware performance differences for ECC-enabled or ECC-off?
So, yeah, we have those numbers quantified. I don't have off the top of my head. I have to go look them up. It's not just ECC on and off the well. Most people, when they have a GPU on their desktop, they're running a GeForce or gaming brand of a GPU. Mm-hmm. And those are going to be clocked higher, because with gaming, honestly, you're running 60 to 120 frames a second. You don't care if one of those pixels is slightly off. Every once in a while, you're not going to see it. And so people will clock those very high, especially the third-party companies who are selling these GPUs. Whereas when you're running your, you know, scientific application, you really care if a bit slips, especially if it's a high-order bit. You know, if you get an error for some odd reason, either because the clock's running too fast or, you know, whatever that is. So that's why ECC is there, is to protect your data integrity, because, again, running a game is a lot different than doing a scientific application. And there's, you know, with memory in general, you know, regardless of GPUs or CPUs, there's chances your bits are going to flip just from various, you know, technical reasons, electronic reasons. And so that's why ECC is there. The other side of it is GeForce GPUs get very little testing compared to what a Tesla GPU will do. So it's, you know, Tesla GPUs go through many, usually 24 hours plus when it comes off the line, where, you know, a GeForce GPU is probably going to get 5 to 10 minutes of testing. So various reasons why they'll see perf differences between their desktop GPU and what they're actually running in the cluster.
Okay, great. Yeah, we often have to handle some of those questions in a very diplomatic way. Let's see, regarding the texture cache, I guess for the advanced CUDA programmer, that's pretty straightforward. But for people using OpenACC, is it up to the, I guess, I don't know how much OpenACC experience you have, but what comes to mind is whether or not a user has to actually mark things within OpenACC so that the compiler can recognize things being passed. I guess the restrict keyword or attribute would be something that would be important for the programmer to put in their code so that the OpenACC compiler can recognize that. But I guess for languages, support for things like Fortran might be a little more difficult. Is there anything that you know of with respect to OpenACC for making sure that being able to access the texture cache with the const data type, const restrict type properties of the data.
Yep. Yeah, so in OpenACC, especially with the C, because with all the pointers, it's really hard for the compiler to figure out where the data is coming from and what it's pointing at. It works a lot better in Fortran since, you know, your arrays are actually array data types for it instead of just a pointer to memory. So the restrict is useful in at least two ways with OpenACC, and especially for C. The restrict tells the compiler that, you know, you're guaranteeing that one pointer doesn't reference data to another pointer. So by doing that, it allows the compiler to make much better optimizations and say, okay, these are actually independent pieces of data, so it can expose more parallelism. So it's always good to put the restrict on if you know it's true, if you know one pointer is not referencing memory that another pointer is pointing to. So that's just good common practice with OpenACC in general. And then, yes, it'll allow the OpenACC compilers to use that data if you add the const on top of it to make use of the texture cache. That is up to the different compiler vendors, whether they implement it or not. Same with, like, OpenACC has a cache directive that informs the compiler that you want to use the shared memory cache available on the GPU itself. And then, again, that's up to the compilers to respect it or not. They can ignore it and just not use it, but they can implement it as well. So they have the capabilities there. I would have to go look at the individual vendors to see if they actually implement the texture-only, read-only cache, but there's no reason they couldn't.
Okay, great. We have one question from actually someone within the Blue Waters project. He's a supporter of OpenCL, and he's wondering if Kepler will be supported in OpenCL 2.0, or other way around, will Kepler support OpenCL 2.0?
So that's not a hardware-specific question. That's on our software side. So we support up to OpenCL 1.1 for legacy applications. We currently have no plans on our roadmap to support anything past that.
Okay. Right. Well, we've been kind of interested. One of the things that we're looking at as the rapid change in accelerator technology takes place is how to make available a common source code type picture that users can then enable their code on a specific accelerator without having to make significant changes to their code. And so we've been, you know, looking at things either through OpenCL.
Yeah, that's the common argument for OpenCL. What we found when we were supporting OpenCL 5050 with CUDA was once you made it performant on your accelerator, you actually got it down to be fast. It was almost as much work porting it to a different accelerator as it was, you know, going to a different language. Even though it's, you know, an open language, if you're getting it functionally portable across all of them, it's not performant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hear that argument a lot. It's one of the problems, you know, with OpenCL. It's their motto is it's as close to silicon as possible, and silicon operates differently depending on the accelerator we're working on.
Right.
So our answer to that was to, you know, really throw a lot of effort behind OpenACC, which is, you know, compiles to all the different architectures, you know, the Xeon 5, AMD, and the NVIDIA GPUs, as well as I think CAPS is showing it working. You can take your OpenACC code and even compile it directly for CPUs.
Yep.
And then on the other side, we open source our compiler to help you know, people implement things like, you know, there's a CUDA Python now, and I know PGI has a toy CUDA x86 compiler, so you can actually just take your CUDA code and compile it to the x86 processor. But like I say toy because they haven't found much of a business case for it yet, so they haven't put a lot of effort into developing it further.
Okay. Good, thanks. Any other questions here? It's interesting to learn. We just got 5.5 installed last week in our test development cluster, so we haven't had a chance to look at a lot of tools, but it is interesting that you can collect NVProf data remotely and then move the data to your desktop. And I guess that would be Insight would be the visualization?
Correct, yeah. That's one of our favorite features of 5.5 is, yeah, you just run it with NVProf, it spits out a data file, and then you can load that with either the standalone NVIDIA Visual Profiler, which is just a Java app that runs on all the operating systems, or if you have Insight, if you're running Mac or Linux, the Insight Eclipse can load that data as well. And then you have, you know, all the visual data. You can actually look at the timeline and see, you know, all your registers and what's using what. And so it's a great way to profile a remote system.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, we like that.
Yeah, there's actually Mark Harris's Parallel for All blog has a kind of a CUDA pro tip coming out on using NVProf. So that'll probably come out this week sometime.
Okay. And so that Eclipse support was through your own thing for Eclipse, or is that something that's generally available through the Eclipse download?
It was CUDA 5. It was a separate install of Eclipse because we needed to make changes to the trunk of Insight itself, the trunk of Eclipse itself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I think CUDA 5.5 are moving to a more of just a plug-in mode like you would expect on Eclipse.
Okay.
I think that's coming out. I think it came out in 5.5. If not, it's coming out in the next release of CUDA.
Great. Yeah, we've had some success with what you guys call Hyper-Q or what Craig's called CUDA Proxy. And I don't think we realized that it was just a special early access for Cray systems, but been able to show some application speed up by using CUDA proxy, especially with OpenACC. I guess the one caveat is you have to keep in mind that even though you're sharing access to the GPU, you're also sharing the memory. So
correct. Yeah.
You can't just swap in and out. You have to think about that memory usage limitations when you start having multiple MPI tests.
The naming definitely got confusing on all that. We Hyper-Q is essentially we have 32 hardware queues now, and then what was called CUDA Proxy is now our multi-process server, the MPS.
MPS. So
marketing guys decided to change the names on us.
Their job, I guess. I don't see any more questions from people who are calling in. Are there any questions from members of our staff here? Any support-related questions that people might want to bring up?
Mark, do you know if any of the OpenACC implementations are starting to target dynamic parallelism yet?
Yeah, so that came out in the OpenACC 2.0 spec, which is now out, and it allows for function calls. In OpenACC 1.0, you couldn't call a function from within a parallelized region unless you inlined it. And that made it really hard to report some codes. So that has now been added to the 2.0 spec. And once they added it, it's now the compiler vendors can support dynamic parallelism. So I know PGI is definitely doing it, and I assume CAFS and Cray will be doing it as well on NVIDIA GPUs. So we should be seeing beta versions of those coming out very, very soon, hopefully before SE13, but at least by SE13.
All right, so it's not out yet. I guess I think we have PGI 13.9, so that'll be something in PGI 14 or something, I guess?
Yeah, that'll be coming out very soon with PGI. Yeah, OpenACC 2.0 is going to make much easier to port to accelerate your existing code without having to rewrite a bunch of it. With the changes made to the data regions, and now you can actually call function calls and separate compilation stuff. So it's a big improvement to the spec.
All right. Well, I don't know if we have any other further questions here, room or on the call. So thanks again, Mark, for making yourself available. And for the people on the call, once we get Mark's slides and cleaned up versions, then we will make a PDF version of that available from the Blue Water Store.
And yeah, if you do think of any more questions, feel free to email me or use the resources I showed here. And,
sure.
We can help
you. Or your Twitter handle. Twitter account.
Yeah, that works too.
Let's see. So I think that's about all we have. We can switch presenters up.
Yeah.
I guess you have to stop sharing on your end.
Yeah, let me see that. All right, I think I gave you the ball back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay, I don't think we really have anything else on our end. I guess we can, if I can get this pulled over in time. Our typical request is one that kind of Bill already highlighted, which would be related to our usual request. So, science input's important, but keep in mind that whenever you have something in the pipeline or, if you've got a preprint coming down that's important and you want us to let NSF know about it, or if you have publications that just came out, we'd like to know, especially important presentations. important as well. And on the wiki, if you don't feel like sending an email, you can always go to the portal and share the results section, and that will automatically notify our public affairs department about things that you have coming down the pipeline. And of course, send me or our ticket system any suggestions you have for future teleconferences and webinars. Hopefully our next one will be on HGS and Globus Online, and we're trying to decide right now when that'll be. Right now we have a conflict with SC 13 being the same week as that week, the third Monday, so we might either move it or postpone until December and move that one up a week so it's not so far into December. So we'll hopefully we'll have some HDF. HDF's another month. Sorry, confusing things. Globus Online and HPSS is what I meant to say. That's the next one. HDF will be farther down, probably in January. All right, that's all I have. Thank you very much for attending, and we look forward to seeing you all on the next Blue Waters User Call. Thank you very much.